it's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome, welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. It's the end of the year, and we know it. I'm your host, Gene Bolduc. I'm your host for the end of the year, and my guest today to join me sailing off this particular cliff is Louise to my Thelma, Aaron Keck.
Why am I Louise to your Thelma?
Okay, you're Thelma to my Louise.
No, I think I like Louise better.
You like Louise better?
Yeah, Louise is better.
It just seems like a better name.
She's got.
I don't remember which one was which. By the way, Louise was. Gina Davis or
was no? I think Louise was Susan Sarandon.
Okay, well,
I saw that movie recently, but I've only seen it once.
Oh, good grief! Yeah, okay, he's going to look that up.
I want to be Susan Sarandon. She had more of a head on her shoulders than that one. Although Gina
wasn't
Davis
wasn't she
kind
driving
of,
though? Was Susan driving at the end of that movie?
I
would have given her a ticket. I think, you know.
I don't think that would have mattered all that much.
But, doing airborne in an on-the-ground zone.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler. There might have been some people who haven't seen that movie. Yeah,
oh, really? Who are those people?
Do
they live in Chapel Hill?
Thelma was Gina Davis and Louise was Susan Sarandon.
Okay, so now you want to be Louise.
We'll go with Louise.
You've
on
just
that
complete.
No,
okay, well, listen,
there
Louise.
Are some people who haven't seen that movie and would be upset to hear the spoiler. I watched Twin Peaks, the TV show, for the first time in
the
like
original?
2000. The original, yeah. Okay. In like 2009, I finally got around after this show had been out for nearly 20 years.
Yes.
I finally got around to watching it, and I was very happy because no one had spoiled it for me. At no point did I actually know
you didn't know who killed Laura Palmer.
Palmer,
right?
So it was a surprise
her
to
father.
Me when
oh,
it got
sorry. Oh, I did it again. Well, oh, so you haven't watched the last
no,
episode?
No, I have
yeah,
watched
okay.
it. I'm just saying. Like,
he's like, I can't believe you did
why
that.
We're going to do this entire show about pop culture today, and it's
yes.
going to be nothing but Gene Bolduc spoiling
just
the ending
spitting
for
out.
People.
Well
who,
let me tell you my side of that, is that my son and daughter-in-law had started watching The Sopranos. They watched it like on demand or on DVDs, or I don't know how they were doing this. And, of course, you know, I watched all of it and watched the last episode,
when it
was, like, lined up there,
right.
Popcorn, appointment TV,
The only episode of The Sopranos I've ever seen is the last episode.
This is exactly what my brother told me when he was here. And I said, you missed kind of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, But just aside, because, you know, we never take a right turn on this show, but just as an aside, my brother is a big fan, and so am I, of the show Blue Bloods with Tommy Selleck. And there's a very distinct style to the show. And when I first started watching that show, I said, oh, right, I've got it. This is The Sopranos, but they're cops.
Yeah.
And it has this feel about it.
Yeah.
I look it up. Well, it's because both shows are the work of Kevin Wade, who is the showrunner. And there's a lot of people on Blue Bloods who came from the world of The Sopranos.
When House came out with Hugh Laurie as like gruff, misanthropic doctor. Mm-hmm. Who's addicted to painkillers and has this horrible bedside manner and hates everyone, but he's a brilliant doctor.
Right.
There are so many ripoff shows that came out afterwards that are basically just House, but he's a detective. House, but he's a auto mechanic. House, but he's a something or other.
I'm going to shock you about that.
Mm.
Well, let me tell you about The Sopranos is that my son and daughter-in-law just were like, don't tell us, because we're in season two, and you know, went on for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And a couple of years ago, I think I said to them, so, you know, hey, The Sopranos, you know, what do you? Well, no, we haven't. I said, listen,
I've waited for
a period of time here that I think is a reasonable period.
Bear in mind that every episode of The Sopranos, or every season of The Sopranos, was 2 years after the previous season because HBO took its sweet time putting that show out. So if you really want to watch The Sopranos, you need to space it out over the course of 12 years in order to have
actually done it right. That's a fair point.
Yeah.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
And you can mark it by Gandolfini's waistline because he goes from being medium large to large large by the end of the series, bless his heart. And
I would not know.
You would not. Well, right, because in that last episode, there you are. But, you know, the beautiful thing about how that show ended, watch how I do this without spoiling it, you don't really know what happened at the end.
You don't.
You know, everybody who loves the show has their version of what happened, including David Chase, who created the show, has his own ideas about it. But he acknowledges that he doesn't own that.
Yeah,
you know, he thinks that the viewers
have
a right
to construct that, so that different people can have their own opinions. The one thing that did transpire out of that last episode of The Sopranos, and this also is not a spoiler, the song that's playing over the top in the last couple of minutes is "Don't Stop Believin'" by Journey.
Right.
And it very abruptly cuts out at the very end with "Don't stop," and that's it.
Yeah, and then
now,
it stops.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
From there on out, everyone assumes that song, in reality, abruptly cuts off there. When in fact it slowly fades out over
the course of a minute.
But I think people who play that song now, we just automatically cut it off right there.
Yeah,
because of The Sopranos.
The song doesn't end that way, but it ends that way on The Sopranos for you, the viewer.
Yes.
And the question is, what happens for Tony and his family after that?
That's just where we're steering into spoiler territory.
Well, so no, I mean, I'm asking you for your conjecture. So what happens? Is that an effort on the part of the showrunner to say, oh, look, we're going to take a few years. You don't know.
No.
You know,
I
if
think
the viewers scream for it, maybe we'll come back for another
the
year.
The conclusion of The Sopranos is like, from what I know about the show, it's very much in line with the show, which is that life can change at any moment.
Right.
But life also goes on.
Right.
So
maybe with you, maybe without you.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's heavy.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Are
Is the whole show going to be like this?
From 2007, we're supposed to be talking about pop culture from 2017.
Well, and I would just point out, by the way, that Will and Grace has come back, and
that's right. We're talking about pop culture from 2007 because it's all been brought back.
Because there's not a new idea.
Will
in
and Grace is back. Twin Peaks is back. Fargo is back. I'm going to go see Star Wars this weekend.
Me too.
Right.
What time are you going? Are you going to the 3:30 on Saturday? Because I'll see you there.
No, Friday.
Okay. Well, see you
Friday morning.
Yeah, we had to wait for the babysitting arrangement so that Grandma and Grandpa could go, because we got the other grandparents babysitting.
By the time this show airs, I will have
you
seen
will know.
It. I will know. Yeah,
you will know exactly who is the last Jedi.
Luke is the last Jedi.
You sure?
Yes.
You
because
positive?
if you watch the Force
Awakens,
you're
going to be so embarrassed if you're wrong.
Well, no, Rian Johnson, the director, said this. Like people came out and asked. Like, there were all these public speculations over who the last Jedi was. And Rian Johnson, the director, tweeted, "It's Luke, people. Just watch
Don't
the
overthink
first movie."
It. Yeah.
Well, The Force Awakens, if you watch the opening scroll, it explicitly refers to Luke Skywalker as the last Jedi.
That's kind
what
of
the
a fair
reference
point, isn't it?
To.
Right.
Yeah. That's not a...
So when you saw that in the theater...
This is not a mystery that needs to be solved.
When you saw that in the theater, The Force Awakens, did the audience erupt in applause when that scroll came on the screen?
By the time the scroll comes on the screen, the audience has already erupted in applause because the audience erupts in applause
when the title comes on.
Before that, because you see Lucasfilm and then that fades out and then a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Right.
And then that like orchestral crash...
Right.
That is just the greatest moment in cinema,
yeah,
period.
Everybody's just
it's
going
all downhill
nuts.
From there, and the
now,
crowd
you,
goes nuts.
Do you know the story about that, that scroll, that was actually Steven Spielberg's idea?
Not a surprise, but
You know, I guess he and Lucas were buddies. They still are.
Yeah.
And when he saw the, you know, kind of a first go at the film Assembled. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, you just drop into the story and there's all this stuff going on and there's so much to absorb.
Right.
You ought to have kind of an introduction, you know, like they used to do in the old serials and in the movies in the 30s and the 40s. So the audience has a sense of a backstory before they dive into this.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, yeah, okay. And I'm thinking, what a signature thing that is.
Right.
It is just like this,
I also
you know,
love the
oh,
fact
by the
that...
way, it was hard for me to pick up on the story. I, Steven Spielberg, had trouble following along. Really?
Yeah. I love the fact that Star Wars and also Indiana Jones, so the Lucas-Spielberg collaboration, were both based on or inspired by those serials
from the
30s and 40s. And those two film series just take off and become so iconic. Those serials from the 30s must have been terrible. Because they didn't take off and become iconic. And apparently all you have to do is
except
do
for
that
these two
story
guys, right?
and do it correctly. And you're the most iconic film franchises of all time. God, there must have been just some incompetent boobs
there must have been a couple of directors around the 70s and 80s going, oh, no, I totally missed it. All I needed was a giant screen and a great story and decent actors. Man, just that one little missing.
didn't even need a great script, just good actors who can.
Right. Well, and a great script doctor in Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
The great, great Carrie Fisher, whose work as a script doctor probably is more deserving of acclaim
than her
Harrison
Ford,
as an
who
actor.
Has his own iconic ads to the Empire Strikes Back script where he ad-libbed, I know, when Leia says, I love you. And then in Raiders of the Lost Ark the next year where it was supposed to be this long sword fight and Harrison Ford says,
just pulls out the gun and shoots
him. Why don't I just shoot him? And like, yep. That is, in fact, what he would do.
Yeah, but the best thing is...
So uncivilized,
The best thing is for Harrison Ford, why'd it have to be snakes? So with that thought, just think about that, folks. Why'd it have to be snakes? Well, because everybody's afraid of something, and
is
for him,
it's
snakes.
Is this your segue back to 2017?
Yeah, this is going to be my... And speaking of snakes, well, we'll be back to talk a little tiny bit about politics, and then of course, a lot more about pop culture, even though
speaking
I can't
of
say
snakes.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of snakes, yeah. Oh, jeez. You're listening, God bless you, to the Weekend Water Cooler. here on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back here on the Weekend Water Cooler. Gene Bolduc here, your host, and joined by Louise Tamaithelma.
Yes.
Aaron Katz.
We'll go with that.
Thank you. We'll go sailing. We'll go off in that direction as they did in that movie without saying too much more.
I'll
about
protect
it.
You up top if you protect me later on.
Okay.
Yep.
Is that a line from the movie or are you
no,
just
that's
saying
just
that?
No, like that's the narrative arc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay.
Louise is the protector early on and then Thelma becomes strong and protects Louise later on.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, all's well that ends well.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, isn't that what Shakespeare said? Look what happened to him.
Yeah, yeah.
So Shakespeare
yes.
did not have any movies out this year that I remember.
That I can remember.
I can remember. I did.
Well, I mean, there was Lady Macbeth that came out, but I think that was...
Did that come out in 2017?
That came out in 2017, yeah.
No kidding. Who was in that?
I have no idea.
I completely missed it.
It was a film titled Lady Macbeth. It's a film with the title Lady Macbeth.
Is
it's
it the
not
story?
The Macbeth story.
Is, it's
no,
not,
I don't think so.
Now, see, here... Okay, are you listening, Hollywood? Here would be an interesting series of movies.
If you've got Hollywood's
like
ear,
Iago's,
this is the first point you want to make right now.
Iago's story, right?
Yes.
Okay, like Lady the story of Macbeth from Lady Macbeth's point of view.
Yeah.
You know, I think there actually was a Broadway play called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Our Dead, yes.
Our
Tom
Dead.
Stoppard wrote it. Yeah,
our Dead,
good.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole industry now of popular culture that takes these classic stories and retells them from
a different character's
from the villain's perspective, usually. So Wicked,
right.
Grendel, the John Gardner book from the 70s, which is the Beowulf story as told by Grendel. What's the other one? Maleficent, the Angelina Jolie movie that just came out a couple of years ago. That's the Sleeping Beauty as told by the... As told by the baddie in that one, the new Wizard of Oz movie that's told from the perspective of the Wizard of Oz on top of Wicked. From a couple of years ago, Oz the Great and Powerful or whatever that was.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that one.
I think James Franco was the wizard, if I remember right.
Was he or
I didn't see
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't him. Was it?
But like, there's that whole industry, of like retelling stories from the perspective of the villain, and I think this is really a cool thing with regard to just sort of popular culture. And American culture in particular, but just pop culture writ large, that it used to be the case that when we told stories to each other, it was this stark line between good and evil.
Right.
The good people were 100% good, and they were also beautiful.
Right.
And the evil people were 100% bad, and they were also
ugly,
and you could tell.
Right.
And now we're seeing that line blur in culture. So the Wicked Witch of the West now becomes the heroine of Wicked. And
she has a story.
And she has her own story. And the fascinating... I love Wicked. I love that musical so much. And one of the fascinating things about it... I haven't read the book, so I'm not that well-versed in Wicked as much as other people. But I love the musical. And one of the fascinating things about it is... it gives you this story without changing really anything.
It fits all the same events.
It fits all the same events. It's not like, oh, Dorothy was evil the whole time. No, none of that. Like all of the characters.
But you know, she did kill her sister. I mean, come on.
But not on purpose, right? And this was.
Well, that's her story. That's the story we've been told before.
But it's also the story in Wicked, right? That like Dorothy just sort of falls into this situation that's already existing, and it's the same thing with.
Falls into it. I saw what you did there.
Literally, yeah. And it's the same thing in the original Wizard of Oz. And all of the characters that you know and like are still positive. Like Glinda's still a good character. The Scarecrow, Dorothy, all of them, they're all still good characters. The Wizard is ambivalent, but he was in the original too.
He was.
It was just fascinating the way they were able to do that.
You know, I found in that story, even as a kid, that there was a lot to not like about the Wizard.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just that he made this fake thing for people to intimidate people.
He's a bully.
He's really. I mean, he's trying to scare the hell out of little kids.
He's got this power complex. Yeah,
that part worked for me when I was a little kid. Yeah. I mean, I never watched that movie alone as a kid. My sister and I, when the flying monkeys came on, especially, we would be under the coffee table. We were terrified of that.
Yeah,
absolutely terrified
of that.
I don't mind saying that. We would probably still do it now if we could fit under that under that table. But the whole thing in Hollywood about how that movie was made and what the themes of the story, that movie is about something else entirely.
Yeah.
That movie is about money.
Oh yeah.
And greed and American culture of chasing the dollar.
Yes.
And all of this stuff that made villains out of those who were chasing the dollar. At the end of an absolutely backbreaking depression that, frankly, in the modern day, we just can't even imagine the hardship that went on for Americans in the 30s.
Well, the original book, too.
You know, that would break you and me in half in a hot minute.
The original book, too, was written in the context of another depression from 1893 and populism and the gold standard, which is the Yellow Brick Road.
Right.
And, like, it's all...
Yeah, the Emerald City, right?
That is the correct interpretation of that book. Yeah,
that's right. You know, the only reason the slippers were ruby is because it appeared better in Technicolor.
Yeah.
It really was. There really wasn't thematically that much going on with that.
Right.
And it's almost disturbing to understand what's really behind some stuff that goes on in Hollywood. But speaking of Hollywood,
hey, there we go.
You know, it feels like a long, long time ago, but there was a little hiccup during the Oscars. You'll remember. way back.
See, we're looking back on the year 2017.
We're looking back on 2017.
As you can clearly tell.
And when we come back from our next break, which is already upon us, actually, we're going to talk about the Oscar ceremony and Warren Beatty and why a guy who's been in acting so long couldn't seem to do anything other than just read the lines that were there for him, even though, you know, there was a thing.
You stay classy, San Diego.
Yeah, stay classy, San Diego. Oh, my goodness. He was just a train wreck. Poor guy. Poor guy. They just, you know, anyway. So we'll talk about poor Warren Beatty standing up there on the Oscar stage with how many gazillion people watching as he did something surprising. And we'll talk about that when we return with Dr. Aaron Keck, Louise to my Thelma, here on the Weekend Water Cooler. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill. And we're back here on the Weekend Water Cooler. Gene Bolduc here, your host, talking with Aaron Keck, and we're reviewing all of 2017. Take all the time you need. You have 10 seconds.
Okay.
So here we are at the end of the Oscars this year. Everybody's rubbing their eyes because the ceremony has gone on too long, as usual. And here comes Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway on the anniversary, I don't know how many years, probably 1,000 years since Bonnie and Clyde.
50 years.
Is it 50?
67 was when
67,
that movie came
that's
out.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
I just watched that movie, by the way, probably
movie.
A month ago. What a great movie.
Oh,
and
so
what
good.
A cast. Ridiculous. Yeah. So here they are on the anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde, and they come out to make the Best Picture presentation. And Warren Beatty, a long-experienced actor and accomplished director, has the envelope. He opens it up, and it says that Emma Stone is Best Actress for La La Land.
Yep.
And someone has just handed him, you know, there are sets of envelopes on both sides of the stage.
Right.
Someone has handed him the wrong envelope. That's what it says on there. It says Emma Stone and in big letters and Best Actress.
Yes.
And then La La Land somewhere else on the card.
Pause for a second and reflect on how smooth an operation the Oscars is.
That this
in
is
so
probably
far
the
as this
first
is the
time
first
this has
time
happened.
That this right. has ever happened, right?
Right. And
as soon as they explain it, I'm like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
kind of surprised,
you know,
that it hasn't happened before.
Why in the world hasn't this happened before?
Yeah.
And Warren Beatty stands up there, and I think that the important thing to focus on is that this is a situation where there is social pressure.
Yes.
He's standing there and he looks at the card and then he looks up and he looks at Faye Dunaway and he kind of gives this funny look and shrugs. He looks off stage. He's just looking around. This is such a common tactic to build, dramatic tension that everybody thinks he's just jerking everybody around.
Right. Including Faye Dunaway.
Including Faye Dunaway, who says, oh, stop it, Warren.
Yes.
You know? And I think, did he not show her the card?
I think he did.
And he's like, okay. And then he finally blurts it out and says, La La Land.
Yeah.
And then, of course, somebody rushes out onto the stage and they straighten this out rather immediately as the cast of La La Land is coming up.
It might have been
somebody from the cast of La La Land said, no, wait, stop.
It was.
There's been a mistake.
Yeah, it was the producer, I think.
Because somehow, because that Best Picture is the producer's award.
Right.
And because somehow Warren Beatty just couldn't figure it out to stop and say, okay, I apologize for this, but I seem to have the wrong envelope, and just turn it around for the camera.
Yeah.
And say, I have the envelope for the Best Actress award. If the stage management could bring me the right envelope, this is very unusual and I apologize.
So,
how easy is that?
So three things all worth being aware of in that situation. Number one, you mentioned social pressure. He's got 100 million people watching him, and he's fully aware of that. So he doesn't want to bring the show to a screeching halt.
Right.
Number two, This is every psychological experiment about the extent to which we as human beings are willing to just go along with whatever authority figures tell us, even if we ourselves are questioning it. So when someone hands him, the person who's in charge of handing him the card, hands him the card with authority and confidence, here you go, Mr. Beatty. He's just going to take it and run with it. And the third thing that I think is also relevant is, as we said, this had never happened before.
Right.
So for someone in that high-pressure moment when someone has authoritatively said, here is the card, for someone in that moment—
And then Faye Dunaway is saying to him, just read it. Just read it.
For someone in that moment to say, wait— this is wrong when there is no precedent for it.
Right.
Is a massive thing to expect someone to do. So it ends up being a fiasco, but it's an understandable fiasco.
Right. Yeah.
See also a whole bunch of unprecedented things that have happened this year that
we don't really come to terms with until after they've happened. It could seem like it's unrelated, but, you know, to me it's not unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
That, okay, let's look at Moonlight, for example. I think a lot of people thought Moonlight had a good chance to win. It might have been something of a dark horse
candidate to win. Moonlight was the best picture,
I suppose.
Eventually got around to seeing both La La Land and Moonlight after the ceremony, and afterwards I was like, oh— Yeah, it's not even a question. Moonlight was way better than La La Land.
Listen, I watched La La Land.
Yeah,
I watched about half of it, and I just couldn't keep going.
The ending is good. You should.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
It comes around. Yeah, it's a fine movie.
Is there a speeding car in a Grand Canyon? I'm just asking.
No, that's a different movie.
That's Twin Peaks. I'm thinking, or The Sopranos. I don't know.
I mean Moonlight is way better, but La La Land is fine. It's decent. I enjoyed it. It was good.
But here's Moonlight. Here's Moonlight, a movie about a black man.
Yes.
A gay man,
mm-hmm.
and it's not about civil rights. It's not about the Civil War. It's not about slavery. It's not really particularly about race. It's not a race events movie. It's not Selma.
Yeah,
you know, and it was an indie movie, was it not?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So
big time.
That's really
race is not irrelevant.
Right. But it's not the central character in the movie.
Yeah.
That's really unusual for that to have broken through in this particular year,
mm-hmm.
won the Oscar for Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know. That just kind of magnifies the impact of that win, that this fluky thing happened,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't malicious on anybody's part. It was just a freak thing.
Yeah.
So that was interesting too, that happened to break through, but to me, that happens, and then in the world of politics. And its collision with Hollywood.
Yes,
you have all of these people, some of them famous, raising their hands and saying "Me too,"
mm-hmm.
and then you have the colossal crash and burn. Now 87 accusers as of today for Harvey Weinstein,
mm.
and that is just an epic event. That by itself. But I thought it was, to me, one of the things that kicked the door open in all of this, not unlike the Bill Cosby case, and we've talked about this extensively before, is that when accusers came forward right behind Weinstein about Kevin Spacey, you know, now it's men. And now it's men saying, this happened.
Yeah.
And that was rather immediately believed.
Yes.
And I think that provided kind of an awakening right there, because these things were happening in, right beside each other in real time.
Yeah. And I think and like I don't want to go too far. I don't want to go too far down this road because I mean we're still seeing it now, even in the context of what has happened in the last few months. That a lot of accusers still have a hard time being believed. There are, you know, accusers come forward about Roy Moore, accusers come forward about Donald Trump, accusers come forward about Al Franken, and you know, any of these figures. And there is still a significant percentage of the population or a significant percentage of the discussion around it that is, well, is that really what happened? Or are you exaggerating? Or are you lying to get publicity and all of that? So there is still that element of it, which is prominent and there and still needs to be broken through. At the same time, I think what's really significant about the last 3 months in the Me Too movement and the extent to which this is actually leading to consequences for people like Weinstein and Spacey and Al Franken and Roy Moore and all of these others is not so much that we're believing the accusers now, but that we're taking them seriously.
Right.
In the case of Harvey Weinstein and in the case of Kevin Spacey, especially Weinstein, but Spacey too, this was known. It was known.
Yeah.
It was an open secret. Family Guy joked about it. But that was the reaction. It was known. It was an open secret. Everyone knew that these guys were serial
and
sexual
really
harassers
shifted,
and predators.
Yeah, it shifted into that issue quickly.
But the reaction to it up until the last few months was to dismiss it, to laugh it off, to joke about it, not to disbelieve, because
the
women who raised those
world.
Concerns were believed, but this is the way of the world. One of the things that I read recently, and I'm kicking myself for not saving it because I can't remember who wrote it or what it was, but it was an expose on sexual harassment in Hollywood and the whole idea of the casting couch and all of the extent to which you had to basically sell your body in order to get ahead with certain producers and agents and executives and people like that. This was written in 1989, and it was this huge expose, but it was sold to a satire magazine. It was sold to a magazine that was.
I remember this. We'll think of this.
It wasn't Mad Magazine, but it was closer to that than to
a hard-hitting.
No, I know
exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And the reason that the authors of that piece sold it to a satire magazine, like a comedy magazine, was that they knew that they wouldn't be able to sell this piece to a hard-hitting journalistic
The New Yorker
journal.
Or The Atlantic.
So
or
instead,
anything. Right.
they wrote it up as this humorous piece, and they submitted it to a humor magazine because that was the level of discourse in 1989. Not that it wasn't believed, but it wasn't taken seriously.
Well,
and now we're taking it seriously.
Well, and if I might just take a little bit of air out of that balloon, also because as a writer, you write stuff and you want to sell it.
Also true.
You got to sell it where somebody's going to buy it.
Right.
So you go where the market is, and if you have to adjust the piece, you want to get it published somewhere.
Yeah.
And
but they
know,
knew where they knew where they could sell it.
In 1989, you couldn't put it on your blog.
Yeah.
So
also true.
Yeah, also true. So so with that sad piece of insight that you didn't have a blog in 1989.
Yeah.
Yeah, cuz I know you didn't. I know you didn't cuz I checked.
The other thing too to keep in mind about Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey in particular, cuz those were the first two and then you had this explosion. Who were the first accusers? With Harvey Weinstein, it was Ashley Judd, right? I think she was
the first
one of the,
of any
the first
profile,
one.
Yeah.
With Kevin Spacey, it was Anthony Rapp.
Yeah.
Right? Both Ashley Judd and Anthony Rapp are prominent figures.
Yeah.
They've got careers of their own.
Yeah. Who, if they
they've
never work for
some,
this guy anymore,
yeah,
they're fine with that.
They've got some power. They've got some clout. They've got, I have to assume, a decent amount of money.
Very, very true.
They don't have as much to lose.
When it stopped being a power disconnect.
Yeah. They don't have as much to lose from coming forward and sacrificing their careers. They've got power and clout already.
Oh, but that's it. They wouldn't be sacrificing their careers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, even if in fact they never worked in this town again, they still have their body of work. They've got their power. They have made their money in Hollywood.
Yeah, so they're like us, Aaron Keck, independently wealthy, just do whatever we want. But here at CHL, we do have sponsors, and they'd like to say a few things to the nice people who are listening.
She's telling me to
You're listening
take a break.
To the Weekend Water Cooler here at 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We're going to wrap up with Aaron Keck, Louise to my Thelma. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with Aaron Keck here on the Weekend Water Cooler. And we are talking. If you're just tuning in, my goodness, we've missed you. Where have you been? Gene Bolduc here. We're talking with Aaron Keck, and we're trying to wrap up this year to some extent. To some category that we're trying to be finished with.
So for those of you following along
about
at home,
pop culture
for
items.
Those of you playing along at home, Gene comes in with this list of 15, the top 15 pop culture moments of the year, and a second list of the most Googled pop culture terms of 2017. And of all of that, we've gotten to one of the items.
I think one or two of the items, right. Well, would you?
Albeit the most significant, like in if we're talking about popular culture in 2017, we're going to talk about the Me Too movement. So
we've talked. We did a whole show on that, and we have talked about it, and because of the nature of what it is, and the fact that it is right now, in my opinion, forming an existential threat to the presidency of the current occupant of the White House.
And I think we'll
be talking about it next year.
Yeah, and is still the tip of the iceberg too,
it
because
really
as
is.
Much as like we're starting to get that pushback, right? Like, oh, the pendulum is swinging too far in the other direction, and oh, like men can't look at a woman in the eye anymore without having to worry, and blah blah blah. Like, no, this is the tip of the iceberg. The point that I was making at the very end of the segment is that the people who are coming forward now are people who have a significant amount of power already.
Right.
There are a lot more people than that who don't have power who still haven't come forward.
Yeah, that's maybe the 5% at the tippy top who have plenty of oxygen and they're fine. And those who are underwater in the situation
we've been talking about the 1% and the 99% all this time. I think that's applicable here,
that
too.
Might
I think what we're
too.
Hearing from now is still the 1%.
That's right. Yeah, they have a lot to say. And at this point, one of the ways that we're hearing a lot from people who make a big difference in our world, and everybody just buckle up because you're going to hear this an awful lot, especially from me next year, are the people who get themselves to the voting booth. And, you know, you may get the one vote, but everybody gets one vote. And collectively, there's been quite a tectonic shift in the power structures in Washington and elsewhere and at the state level. And there's going to be changing faces and names in various levels, in every level of government. We're going to have new people on school boards and county commissioners and city councils and so forth all across the state. As we should. You know, it's just not necessarily a great thing just indefinitely to have the same people running again and again and again. We want continuity. We want institutional memory, to be sure. But, wow, you need new blood. You need fresh perspectives. And right now, I think there's going to be a great big injection of estrogen in the American political process. And this time next year, we could be looking at record numbers of women. We're already looking at record numbers of women in Congress, especially.
But we're talking about this week. The North Carolina Democratic Party on Monday of this week released a list of new people who had filed or are going to file to run for state office in 2018.
Right.
And it's women. Like, it's women who are energized. It's women who are fired up. It's women who are coming forward and saying, this is my time.
Right.
I'm going to run. Right. I want to be a part of this process.
And I have to say, just, you know, to bring all of this full circle at the risk of a cliche, the last shall be first, this all goes back, in my opinion, to the Women's March. I mean, honest to God, it's going to be Donald Trump that relaunches the women's movement.
Yeah.
That march, for me, for many people, was a real eye-opener that, yeah, you know, we are all still out there. That march was just one of the most nurturing and uplifting in experiences as an activist that I've absolutely ever seen, that anybody's ever seen. And it was all over the place, and it was families, and it was called the Women's March. There were plenty of men there, all of them supporting women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a generation ago, that might have freaked out some men and whatever about, well, wait a minute. I mean, you know, supporting women, there's a way to support women. You know, look, you have a daughter. You want her to be the greatest, right? I mean, so support your daughter. Support your wife. That's the support we're talking about. Grow up. America's growing up on this point.
Yeah. And to put the period on the end of that sentence, what movie have we been talking about this entire time?
Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise,
yeah.
Right? Which comes out 25 years ago, and it's everything that we're talking about in 2017. It's sexual harassment.
Right.
It's sexual assault.
Right.
It's female empowerment.
Right.
It's a power hierarchy that is gendered, where men are sort of banding together, where men are believed before women are, even with all of the evidence to the contrary.
Right. And it's Brad Pitt, too.
And it's Brad Pitt,
just gotta
too.
Just got to say that.
All, like,
we
and,
both appreciate
and
that.
And again, what a time capsule of 1990-91 when that movie came out.
Just amazing.
How different and how similar a story would that be?
Right on the eve of the Clinton administration.
Right.
Not insignificant there either.
Yeah. If it were told today. And there's still a long way to go. I mean,
Okay, Hollywood. What about that sequel?
Right.
What about their kids?
Well, let's also talk about the other thing that you mentioned in popular culture, the announcing of La La Land as Best Picture, when in reality it was Moonlight.
Right.
Who said that?
Yeah.
Warren Beatty.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Let's talk about
Warren Beatty, really?
Right?
Oh, my goodness.
Like,
well, that's our next show, because, wow, are we over on time. Thank you so much for joining me, Aaron Keck, and we'll see you next week. And next week is going to be our New Year's Eve. Not next week, but in 2 weeks, will be our New Year's Eve show, and we maybe should have champagne or something.
Ooh,
we'll do something special, as far as you know. Mm. Yeah, that'd be great. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back in 2 weeks before you know it.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc, and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.